In my ongoing mission to interview homeopaths from around the world, I was lucky enough to come across Abdul Hay Holdake, one of the first ever homeopaths in Egypt. I was so intrigued and inspired by the story he shares of how homeopathy came to be established in Egypt and how it's been flourishing ever since. Abdul Hay trained with many different homeopaths in person, and he shares my philosophy of blending various homeopathic techniques to suit our own individual style of prescribing. This is the ethos of his teachings at the Holistic and Homeopathic Resource Center, which you can learn more about at www.h2rc2.com. Abdul Hay was also responsible for getting Amy Lansky's book, The Impossible Cure, translated into Arabic and published, and it is currently the only good book on classical homeopathic prescribing in that language. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now my mum and your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, homies, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangout. Today, we have a lovely guest, Abdul Hay Holdake, in Egypt, but at the moment, you're in Paris, right? Welcome to the show, Abdul.
That's right. Thank you for inviting me. Sounds like you're doing a very interesting job there.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a very interesting job, which I'm seriously excited to dig into. I didn't know that Abdul means servant. And you just, before we started recording, said something really interesting about your name, Abdul Hay. And can you just talk to us a little bit about that? And also, just any of our listeners who are being thrown by the accent like me, you've got the Dutch surname. You're in Paris at the moment after having just been in Amsterdam, but you actually live in Egypt. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, it's a rather long story, but in general, I grew up abroad. My parents traveled a lot. So I was born in Holland, but we went to Sumatra and then Singapore and America. And so my training is usually in international schools. That's why I have this particular accent. And some 40 couple of years ago, I met a Sufi sheikh. And this Sufi sheikh gave me my name in Damascus when I was visiting Damascus at the time. And in the Islamic tradition, God has 99 names. That's a symbolic number. But many people are called then by the servant of one of those 99 names. So Abdul means servant, sometimes translated as slave, but it can mean both, of that particular name. So my name is Hay, means the living. So I'm the servant of the living, right? And so he gave me that name, and it's kind of stuck with me since then.
Incredible. And can you please tell us your journey, Abdul, how you were first introduced to homeopathy? How did that come across your path?
Well, I've always, you know, I'm a kind of generation of the 60s and 70s. So, and I was already particularly very much into alternative everything. So even in university, you know, I stayed in a commune for a while. I was into alternative agriculture and stuff like that. And I was in an ashram for 9 months, living a very simple life, simple food, etc. When I got married and then had children, I didn't want to use any kind of modern medical intervention. And we started studying a little bit of herbalism, and we had a Chinese friend who did some acupuncture. And then I happened to come across George Vatulkas's book on homeopathy, and I was so fascinated by it that I read it through, and I gave it to my wife, and she read it through, and it happened that Carol Boyce was running a charity in London, and she was on her way back from Iraq, stopping over in Cairo and visiting a friend of mine who was the Minister of Finance, and he was into alternative stuff. And I met her there, and she said, I run this homeopathic charity. We would, you know, and I said, well, I'm interested in studying homeopathy, because I had started a course with the people in England. They had a correspondence course, which I did for 6 months with the tapes. And I realized I needed a homeopathic teacher. I couldn't do this long distance. And so she happened to appear in front of me. And I said to her, would you be willing to send homeopaths here to train a group of us? And I said, I'll collect the people. And she said, yes, we'll send them, and they will not require any fees or whatever. And so our very first teacher was Ian Watson and Robin Murphy. And so they stayed with us at home for 2 weeks, and we, you know, they toured Egypt and things like that, but they gave us courses, and we used to sit with them, and they would give our, you know, have clinical discussions and things like that. And this went, we did this 3 years. Basically, we hosted about 14 homeopaths. They would come, they would stay with us. They would teach the classes for 2, 3, 4, 5 days. And in the meantime, we would have discussions and we would see how they would be prescribing and things like that. So that was our initial training. Because when we had the children, I didn't want to use any kind of medical system. And we were kind of randomly doing things. With the homeopathy, it became very systematic. And our children, who are now in their 30s and 40s, have never taken any antibiotics or painkillers or anything like that, just simply because we saw how it worked. And also, each of the homeopaths had a very particular approach. Some of them even used remedy makers. One of them only prescribed using a remedy maker and had very good success. And so from that point of view, I wasn't yet into the sort of theoretical wars of the homeopathic philosophy yet.
Yeah.
I just saw it, you know, it worked this way, it worked that way. Well, we'll try it out. Then one of our teachers was Peter Chappell, and Carol Boyce's charity finished, and Peter Chappell volunteered to also, if we paid part of the fees, to send us people for 2 years to give us a diploma from the London School of Homeopathy. And so we did that for 2 years. And after that, Ian said to me, well, you know, you have enough. You know, I'd been treating patients on the side. I was teaching at university, but I was also treating patients for free. I've treated patients for the last 25 years for free in Egypt because I had a job. You know, I had an income. I know that homeopathy is not exactly an income stream that you can survive on easily. But that was part of what we did. And my wife also did the training with me. She's a very good prescriber, but she's an artist. So she never did it professionally. She just helped people left, right, and center. And that's, Ian said to me, I'll cooperate with the Lakeland School of Homeopathy. You become the international lecturer and we'll give the diploma from Lakeland. And so I did that for about 10 years. And then one of the founders passed away. And then Robin Murphy offered to share the degree with me. So until Robin Murphy passed away, I was giving a degree from Robin Murphy's school. I'm sort of the international branch. So that's how it is. And so pretty much every homeopath, unless they've come from abroad, has been trained either with me or by me.
And I think I read like the last 18 years you've been teaching, right?
Yes. Yes.
If you're wondering why your monitor was going green there for a second or why my face is going green, it's not issues with the coloring on the monitor. I was just literally going green from jealousy. I cannot imagine these people coming to your home, these like giants in homeopathy, and just learning directly from the masters. That, I mean, they say that, you know, you don't, like, homeopathy finds you. And it certainly sounds that that was the case with you. I don't even know what to say.
Yeah. And that was the beauty of it. So I got Robin Murphy's degree only through his audio tapes. I mean, obviously, we met him many times when he came to Egypt and everything, but my wife and I did his whole audio course. And we learned a great deal from each one of them. And that's part of our practice, is really, I think what I learned most is about the practicality of it. I'm a standard Western skeptic kind of thing. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So I don't care what the theory is, it has to work. If it works, then I will take a look at it. And so the school that I now have, and I'm now twinned with the Belgian School of Homeopathy. This was arranged by a friend of ours. And basically, I see that homeopathy it's like a toolkit. So now I understand that, you know, sometimes you need the screwdriver, sometimes you need a hammer, sometimes you need a wrench. You can't really say this or that is necessarily going to be the only way of doing things. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, I'm so extremely excited to hear you say that, because that is unfortunately one of the things in homeopathy. I try not to talk about it in the podcast too much. In 200 odd episodes, it's only been maybe briefly mentioned here or there. But unfortunately, there is a lot of animosity amongst homeopaths themselves, as if it's not bad enough that we have so many skeptics from around the world giving us a hard time. There's a lot of conflict between homeopaths for the various different ways that we prescribe. And every person believes that their way is the best way. So to hear you saying that, and I love that visualization of, you know, sometimes you need a screwdriver, sometimes you need a hammer, sometimes you need a wrench, because it doesn't have to be all or nothing. We've got this smorgasbord of beautiful modalities that we can use with countless remedies, and it doesn't have to be one or the other. We can pick and choose, and you can change. You don't have to stick with one modality for the whole of your life. If you find a different one that you find is better, then go there. And in my practice, I've definitely found when I get to a stage where I have a bunch of cases and the universe likes to send them to me, and then I just get stuck with them and I'm like, okay, there's a pattern here. What's going on? And then I have to go look outside of what my current toolboxes. And you will be guided when it's time for you to go on that journey and go find some other tools there. They're all there. Don't have to know about all of them all at once. They will find you.
Yes, yes. And there was an interesting, I was in a conference in Bruges 2 or 3 years ago with all the big ones, Scholten, Shankaran, all of them, sure. And they did this case, live case on the stage, right? They didn't completely finish taking the case. And then each one of these, you know, luminosities gave their prescription. Every one of the prescriptions was different. And so I never knew what they eventually the patient got. But it was a demonstration for me that, you know, yeah, you can approach it from many different ways. And their analyses were beautiful. It wasn't that they were, you know, just simply they were prescribing from their particular theory and they were giving what they thought was the best remedy and whatever. I don't know what worked in the end, but that's how we learned it, basically. And you have to, in the beginning, the course, my course itself, of course, we basically concentrate on the core principles of classical homeopathy. That's basically what you have to have. You have to have that really sort of body of knowledge, and you have to keep expanding it. You have to keep learning and all of that. But in the application, you have to try different things, and certain things will not work. The sensation method developed because a lot of the cases were not getting resolved. Then you had, you know, homeopathic detox therapy works in certain particular kinds of cases. I mean, there are all different ways in which you can apply these techniques.
And I think you said that at your school, that your students learn a little bit of everything, right?
Yes.
So what are some of the things that they might be exposed to in there? Is it 3 or 4 years that they do?
They do 3 years, a weekend per month. Mm-hmm. Which is a full weekend. It's about 11 hours of teaching. And then they have study groups and they have assignments and materials they have to work on. Mm-hmm. And then they have to submit some cases. They have case observations online. There's a whole bunch of things that they do. One of the also the other things that I do in my course, which I don't think most homeopathy courses do, is that I do self-development. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that you cannot I believe that you cannot heal somebody unless you're whole. So I have a weekend on shadow work. I have a weekend on multiple subpersonalities and how to access those things. So in a way, the homeopath has to develop in a particular way in order to be able to be open and flexible for the kind of people that they're going to be receiving. And so that's part of what I do. I don't pretend that they're going to be ready after 3 years. None of us do. I mean, I'm still not ready after 20.
So, I agree. I'm not ready after 10.
But what I want to do is give them the kind of tools to be able to be flexible enough to take on new material and know how to integrate it. And so I have a section on cell salts, for example, because Robin Murphy was very big on cell salts and had very good success with cell salts. I have the classical sort of materia medica material. I have the different potencies. I compare different potency prescription methods. Robin Murphy was also, you know, low potency prescriber, LM potency prescriber. And then I contrast it with the various other methods. So each, I bring in Vatulkas's levels of health. I try to bring in as much as possible of the theory. And in the beginning, it's kind of confusing for students because there is so much to integrate. Mm-hmm. But by the second year, they're becoming more comfortable. I also teach Heiner Frey's polarity analysis method, because Heiner Frey came to Cairo and gave a big seminar. And I also used his method. And I find it very good for beginner students because the remedies are limited. The technique is very straightforward, etc. And so by the second year, they've got at least one solid thing that they can begin to use. I also use the subscriber-based Complete Dynamics, which is a real savior because he gave us a special deal for Egypt. And so students for 3 years get a subscription-based thing for this repertory. And it saves me a lot of work because there's the materia medica on it and there's a very good repertory. So these are all the sort of things that I do throughout the 3 years. And currently it's only online, because I've kind of shifted a little bit of my emphasis to a course that I teach called the Who Am I course. It's a 9-month course, which partially comes from this homeopathic self-development stuff. And because I taught at university a course called Who Am I for students who are Egyptian in an American educational context. And that seems to be very popular. And since I'm officially retired from university, I only try to do these teaching things a little bit. That's it.
I was going to ask you, because you mentioned about not charging for the homeopathy because you had another job. So what was the other job that you were doing, and what were you teaching at university?
For 34 years, I was part of what is an American university system called the Writing Program, and then became the Department of Rhetoric. So I was instrumental in establishing something called the Department of Rhetoric. And it was basically the American universities teach you how to research and write in an academic format. And then it also expanded into different formats of writing for business writing, for artistic writing, creative writing, etc. So it became a department. And I got bored with it towards the end. And then I developed the first interdisciplinary course in the university for the students who I thought were not integrating as people. So this was the Who Am I course that I developed for freshman students. And it's still being taught. So I brought in psychology, sociology, alternative medicine, yani all kinds of things. And then I developed a similar course for the seniors called Integral Living. And so that's sort of where I went. I became the associate chair of the department before I retired. And when I retired, I just had enough of academia. But all through that time, academia allowed me to have my homeopathic practice. So the university was basically paying for my existence, and homeopathy was my passion.
It's sometimes quite nice having a foot in both worlds, though, like keeps you grounded and keeps you real. I absolutely love that you do personal development as part of your training. And, you know, I have these chin wags with Marcus Fernandez on the podcast, and we've often said you can only help your patients as much as you have developed yourself. Like, your practice will never outgrow your personal development. So in order to take your clients further, you need to take yourself further. And I think it's something that we don't put enough emphasis on. Like, really, you can get so caught up in the hoo-ha of daily life and the clinic and everything else, but really we need to take that time for ourselves and look at our own shadow sides and our own triggers and our own traumas and things in life to be able to really help our clients. And some of that also just comes with time and experience. Like, I look at where I am now and, you know, 10 years ago, and you can do personal development, but some of that is actually just time and being exposed to more different things.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm just so blown away by, sorry, I'm still at the start of the conversation where you're saying these people are coming to your home. I'm just so blown away by how, I mean, were there any homeopaths before you in Egypt? Is this something completely new, or was it ever something that was there before?
There was, when I first arrived in Cairo and I started the homeopathy, I asked around, and there was one doctor, a woman called Neda Zirik, I think it was her name, and we became friends. She was practicing in a hospital and she was a regular MD, but she was the only one that was practicing. And there was an interesting story I heard, because she was practicing in her office and one of the regular hospital doctors came in and was curious, you know, what was she doing? And he saw these books on her shelf and he took one of the books down, and it was a Materia Medica published in 1912 or something like that. So he's looking through this book and he says, but this book is published in 1912. He said, yes, because your information changes every day, but ours does not change once it has been established. And I remembered that story because I found that she was being much more scientific than any doctor she was encountering. She passed away many years ago, but she was the very first one. But I was the first one to get people to be trained, basically. And most of us were lay homeopaths. We had, I think, one MD. Mm. And so the majority of the initial group, we were about 20 people that I collected that trained with these people.
Incredible. And are there any rules or regulations on using homeopathy in Egypt, as the government's kind of, you're flying under the radar?
You're all flying. The only place where there seems to be some regulation is in the Gulf, in Dubai and Kuwait and Abu Dhabi, in these places where they've initiated if you have a legitimate diploma of some kind that you can demonstrate to them, then you're allowed to practice. All other Middle Eastern countries except Israel, pretty much the Arab world, there is no idea about what, you know, whether it's legal or illegal. The only thing you cannot do is advertise that you're healing some medical condition, which is generally the case. Mm. But there is no regulation. Occasionally, the doctor syndicates will get upset and say that we need to do something, etc. But in general, I tell people to keep a very low profile. Mm.
And so can you find homeopathic remedies in health shops or pharmacies over there, or is it only from a homeopath?
No. The thing is, you know, I told you that we trained with Robin Murphy, and Robin Murphy had this philosophy. I visited him in the United States a couple of times, and he had a box, which was like a fisherman's box. And he had a supplier in New Mexico who made homeopathic remedies in bullet boxes, you know, recycled bullet boxes. You know, the Americans love bullets.
Yeah.
So he called them his magic bullets, and he had these little cases, and he had this case full of different potencies. And he said, if they ever make it illegal, I have my own pharmacy, right? He was a sort of survivalist American mentality in the homeopathic field. But his philosophy was one that I kind of applied in Egypt. He told me, he said, make it a grassroots movement. Don't try to legalize it. Make it so that people are practicing and that they can't deny it when it is already in practice. And that sort of was my approach, is that I said, if I train enough people in Egypt, it will not die out, because once people have done it, they know how useful it is. And now it's kind of self-sustaining already because I've trained enough people.
Oh my gosh, I'm smiling ear to ear. I love that so much. And he was definitely a down to basics kind of guy. I never had the privilege to meet him in person, but you know, common sense, if I think of his teachings and everything that he did, it's just common sense, I feel. But yeah, if you empower the people with homeopathy, then nobody's going to be able to take it away from them. That's what I felt here in Perth as well, and why I really want to create a grassroots movement here. And with a podcast as well, just to get the Joe Blogs on the street using homeopathy, because when the governments decide, and this is happening all the time, all over the world, you know, they rear their heads and they try to take it away from us. If nobody's using homeopathy, nobody's going to stand up for it. And so we need this grassroots movement of people that are actually going to march to parliament or sign petitions or make a big hoo-ha. I would say if you try and take a mum with a screaming, teething baby who has had success with chamomilla, if you tell that mum, sorry, your chamomilla is illegal, there's no way you're going to get past that mother. She will fight to the death to make sure she has access to her chamomilla.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. In the beginning, the remedies were a problem for us. I mean, I got a lot of the remedies from the supplier in the United States, and I still have the old kits, the bullet boxes. But of course, as our practice expanded and we needed more specific remedies, one of our students was a pharmacist, and she actually went to Helios to train. And she actually doesn't make the remedies because I think it's too difficult for her to do that, because also alcohol is difficult to get in Egypt because it's a Muslim country. So you can't even get medicinal alcohol. So she generally brings in the remedies and copies them and makes kits for us. We have used, and this, of course, makes me a heretic in the homeopathic eyes, is I have used the remedy makers, mainly because we couldn't have access to the remedies, and there were sometimes unusual potencies and things like that. So we had a McGurk machine very early on from London, and there was an incident. And, you know, again, I'm a skeptic. So I said, you know, machine, come on. So we were in Sinai, and we were camping in one of our favorite places. And there was some of the Israelis used to come across the border and camp there as well. So there was suddenly we were called, because the people that ran the camp knew that we practiced homeopathy, and they were saying, come, 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 somebody has burned themselves. And so they had one of these gas cookers had exploded in one of the Israelis' hands and had severely burned his hands and singed his face. So the only thing we had with us was the remedy maker. And so we started making remedies and prescribing and prescribing and prescribing. And we had to leave the next day because the children were gone to school. So we left them with all the remedies and told them what to do. So a week later, we get a call from Israel. And of course, you know, the Egyptian secret police monitor all the telephone calls. And we thought, oh my God, we're going to Israel. And it was this man. And he said to us, he says, I want to thank you so much, because the burn left no traces whatsoever. I healed extremely quickly. And you know that I am a healer and my hand is my most important instrument. And so when I heard this, I said, okay, if I have to use the remedy maker, I will use it. I generally use the remedies if I have them from the kits. But if I don't have something, we will use those.
Oh, you've just given me goosebumps. That is so cool. And I just received my remedy maker machine a couple of weeks ago. I haven't used it yet because it arrived just before we went on holiday. We've only just come back. So it's sitting there. I'm working up the courage to go and use it, because I had Jill Turland on the show. She's 80 and still practicing here in Australia, and she's used a remedy maker her whole life. And Robin Murphy, yeah, I know, used remedy makers as well. He said that he would sometimes use the remedy makers and sometimes use the remedies. And so I'm trying to be a little bit braver and, you know, turn that machine on and start using it. So I will be using it soon. But it's one of those things, we've always got to stay open-minded, don't we?
Well, again, I heard a story recently. You know Elise Timmerman?
Yes, she's been on the show as well.
Yes, she's a good friend of ours. And Elise was very good friends with a South African woman who basically spread homeopathy in most of sub-Saharan Africa. And she told me the story. She passed away recently.
Yeah. We talked about her on the show. I'm trying to think of her name now. Anyway, I know who you're talking about.
Yes, she basically was married to a very rich husband who was working for a company. She was in London and she got interested in homeopathy and her son got ill and her husband was not convinced about this homeopathic stuff. So she sent him to the Royal Homeopathic Hospital and Fubister was the head pediatric clinician there and he cured the boy. And Fubister met her and talked to her and said to her, I want you to take all these books back with you to South Africa. There's no homeopathy in South Africa. He gave her a whole bunch of books. And then he said, don't tell anybody in the hospital, but here is a machine that you can make remedies with that I've been using for years. And it was one of these card machines. I don't know if you know the Ray machines.
Yeah, I've seen them.
Ian Watson used it. And she took this remedy maker back to Africa and she practiced for many, many years, only acute emergency stuff with this remedy maker. And when she spread homeopathy to other countries in Africa, one of the gifts she always gave was one of these remedy makers.
Wow. I think her name was Elvia. I just remembered.
Elvia, that's right.
Yeah. And she, I think it was only last year that she passed away and she was about 90 that's years right. old. And I think, yeah, one of the ladies on the show was saying she was still sending out prescriptions on the day that she died.
Yes, yes.
And something else interesting I've found, have you heard of the Narayani remedies?
Yes.
Yeah, and that actually Narayani trained Elvia as well. So there was this whole, just everyone just knows everyone. And the more I speak to people, the more I'm like, oh, this person, that person was influenced by this person. It's really beautiful. But how cool about Fubister? I did not know that part.
Yes.
That's very cool. These little tidbits are just, they're gold. Now, another very interesting little tidbit is that you helped to translate Amy Lansky's book, Impossible Cure, into Arabic, which if there was only ever going to be one book that was translated, I think even more so than the Organon, I think Amy Lansky's book is the one that should be translated in all languages. It's a beautiful book. She was my first guest I had on the podcast.
Oh, really? Yeah, I read a lot of, because I'm an academic, so I read a lot. So I was reading all the homeopathy stuff, and I found her to be the most succinct author in terms of describing all the different aspects of homeopathy. And because she personally experienced that with her son, I thought this is the perfect book to translate. And I basically, not crowdfunded, I had friends who had money. I said, would you be willing to translate this? And I got a UN translator to do it. And then I had it reviewed by the Arab-speaking homeopaths. And then I got another friend who printed the book. But of course, there was no market. Mm. And when the book was published, I distributed it to some bookstores. It wasn't taken. And then I finally said, okay, we have all these books. They're going to be useless if we don't do something with them. So I started distributing them to my patients. So some of the homeopaths I offered, I said, if you have patients who speak Arabic, don't speak English, give them this book and it will, this way it's kind of has a ripple effect. And so we're basically, that's how we're doing it. We never made any money on it or anything.
That is a really good book to give to any home user. And my clients who have read that book, they get much better results from their consultations because they understand the whole process on such a deeper level. And Amy wrote it in such an amazing way that anybody can understand it. And let's face it, we all love stories and we all love a personal experience. And I love how she's woven that in with Tale of Homeopathy. It was beautifully done.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, very nice.
Amazing. So is there anything else that you can tell us about the scene of homeopathy in Egypt or maybe where you're hoping to see things going in the future? Where do you other homeopaths that have qualified, are they busy in their practice? Is it really hard to make gains? With COVID, it seems around the world, homeopathy really thrived. Did you find that in Egypt? I mean, what do you see the future of homeopathy like in Egypt?
Well, you know, I always remember there's a famous thing, you get the politicians you deserve, or you get the medicine you deserve, right? So I think that by definition, you're going to attract a certain kind of clientele, certain kind of people that are interested. Most of the people that I teach these courses to don't necessarily go on to become professional practitioners. And that's actually the purpose of the exercise, is that when we talk about a grassroots movement, you want to have people that are educated in the system, but don't necessarily, they use it for their family, for their friends. They have an alternative way of viewing the medical practice, medical practitioners. And so I think maybe only about a tenth of all the people that I've taught maybe 300 or 400 or so, will go on to practice. We have thriving homeopathic practices in Egypt. There are a lot of people. And I don't really kind of expect anything specific, because I know that some people will find their alternative healing modality once they finish the course. Some people become body practitioners of some kind, osteopathic practitioners. Some use bioresonance machines. Mm. Some become flower essence practitioners, some whatever. And in that sense, there has been a great interest and revival in all kinds of alternative practices. Robin Murphy was the one who initiated me into that, but I do Qigong before all my classes. So do a half hour to 45 minutes of Qigong with my students, because it's the only way you can experience energy. So if you're an energy practitioner, you've got to experience energy. How are you going to, you know? So I do this with most of my courses. So some become Qigong practitioners, some become whatever. And so it's just spreading that overall awareness to everyone at all levels that makes it then become sustainable. And we have some very good practitioners, and we attract people coming from abroad. Shankaran came several times, and Scholten came a couple of times. So we're exposed to many different kinds of practice, and this kind of has sustained the community.
That's amazing. I mean, Egypt is a pretty amazing location. I think that's a good way to get practitioners.
That's one of the reasons. One of the reasons the homeopath has liked to come was because it was Egypt.
Of course. Yeah. Wow. So Abdul, hey, if you were to kind of leave our listeners with a final message, what message would you want to leave them with? And how can people find out more about you?
You can't find out more about me.
You can't.
Part of the principle of Who Am I course is that you never really see anybody.
It sounds like you're going into a whole different podcast here.
That's right. My message would be that this concept of being open and flexible, that allowing yourself to be able to explore different avenues rather than rejecting them outright. It's also very interesting that, as you probably know, almost 90 to 95% of my students are women. And most of the patients we get are women. They seem to have this ability to be open to change, to be able to take things for what they are, rather than imposing a theoretical blind in front of what they're experiencing or what they're learning or whatever. So I think it's in this part of my Who Am I course also is this business of being open and flexible, allowing yourself to explore those avenues that you think might be productive for you. And they come at the, usually, as you say, you know, they come at the time you need them. But the point of understanding that is you have to be open to the fact that you need it. If you're not open, you're going to miss it. And so I think that that's one of the things, especially in homeopathy, you have to be flexible, and both in terms of your clients and in terms of your own practice.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you, your domain name is H2RC2. What does that stand for?
I wanted to make it sound scientific. It was very early on that I got it. It's
okay.
It's Holistic and Homeopathic Research Consulting Center.
Okay. Which is
that's too long. So it looks like a chemical formula of some kind. So I sound very scientific on my
It website. Does. I love that. Amazing. So you said you retired. So maybe we have got a couple of people in Egypt that listen to the podcast. I don't know who they are, but if people want to seek out a homeopathic practitioner in Egypt, have you got a place where they can get hold of them, or how would I
can always recommend, Danny. I have the graduates are listed on my website, and some of them are practicing, some of them not. So usually I'm contacted personally. And so people can always contact me via the website. The email is there.
Amazing. Well, Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Abdulhai. You have completely just made my day. You have gotten me excited all over again about the interconnectedness of homeopathy, right? Like, we're all so interconnected. We all are just here for the higher good of humanity and helping and serving. And it's beautiful to see you as such a living example of that. So thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Thank you, Eugenie. And thank you for hosting me. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.